You're listening to Finding Your Genius Zone with Dirk Novell. With the help of successful individuals across industries, Dirk breaks down the unknown parts of every vocation while highlighting the importance of finding a career where you can leverage your natural skills, passions, and interests. Now here's your host, Dirk Novell.
Everybody, this is Dirk Novell. Welcome to my podcast. On with me today is the Honorable Judge Alicia Burton. Welcome, Alicia.
Thank you.
Now, did I say that right? Are you supposed to say honorable?
Yes.
Okay.
I
always mess up titles. Okay. So Alicia, I really haven't known Alicia that long. I've known of Alicia and I actually met her before. Alicia is married to an old friend of mine, Dean, who I grew up with. Our dads were pilots, and Dean was always one of those guys I looked up to. I was kind of a tough guy, or so I thought. And then I met Dean and his brother, and they kind of showed me what tough is. So I've always had this image of don't mess with Dean. But anyways, welcome, Alicia. I really am happy you're on with me today. You know, people are coming in hot. You're going to be, you know, your title is judge. So people interested in law in that world are coming in to listen to you. So maybe we'll just start off right away and you can tell the audience a little bit about what your role is now and maybe talk a little bit about how you became a judge. I think it was about 4 years ago and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah. So I was appointed by Governor Inslee in, I think my appointment came around November 2019. I took the bench January 2nd of 2020. And if you're doing the calculations, you know that that was approximately 2 months before the world shut down. So judging pre-COVID was completely different than it was obviously when COVID hit. And so my first 2 months, it was like drinking from a fire hose in terms of trying to wrap my brain around this huge job. And then everything shut down. And in some ways for my job, that was a blessing in disguise. It let everything go at a much slower pace. I was able to read and learn and just observe at a much slower pace than I would have had we been progressing. So we shut down for a while, not long, and then little by little things picked up again. I have been now on the bench for over 4 years. In that 4 years, I did a criminal rotation. So all types of felony trials. I went out to our juvenile court and was the presiding judge out there where I did just about everything. I did all the presiding responsibilities plus abuse and neglect cases and the criminal offenders. And now I'm back downtown in our main county city building and I'm doing family court. So I'm doing parenting plans, minor guardianships, dissolutions, basically deciding where kids go. Yeah, so that's why. Yeah.
Sorry. Before we go backwards in time, I just, you know, sometimes you're going to say something. I want to jump in because I'll forget to ask you later. So you've had this experience of different flavors of being a judge. Are those areas that you pick or does somebody say, hey, Alicia, you now have to go deal with family law or whatever?
The latter. So our court operates on a 9-year master calendar and each of our rotations for the most part are 18 months. And so that master calendar is planned and plotted long before I came on board. So when I came into my department, which is Department 22, I already knew what my 18-month rotations were going to be. And for the most part, they stagger like mine have. You know, you'll do a criminal and then you'll do either civil or family or juvenile, and then you'll come back to criminal. Mine isn't unusual by any means. But no, I did not get any say in it.
And the reason I ask is I'm thinking if, like, let's just say you're somebody that's had a tough life, right? Maybe you were a foster child, or maybe you had a tough parent, a dad, mom, just maybe not the greatest experience. And then all of a sudden, fast forward, you're a judge, and now you're asked to be in that world for 18 months where you have a lot of these beliefs and experiences. I guess the question I'm asking for is what happens when you're a judge and you're put into an area or a specialty that you might have strong feelings towards and maybe your opinions are based off your own experience?
So we would let, and we have let judges not do a particular rotation if something about that rotation hits too close to home. We have a therapeutic court, mental health court. And if you, and we have had judges who have a child with mental health issues and felt like it was just too close to home for that judge to preside over that docket. So there are certainly exceptions. The problem is that that can happen even within a rotation that you think you're going to be fine with. And then you'll get one set of circumstances that really hit home. And that's when you have to dig down deep and try and maintain your composure and just get through it. But in terms of rotations, certainly if you had a situation where you didn't feel it was a right fit for you emotionally, our court would be very willing to have somebody else swap out with you.
Okay. And let's just say you're really, really good at one area. So you're like, I don't want to rotate. This is where I'm like the man or the woman, or I'm the best. And this is where I should be. Is there an option to stay put, or is this a Pierce County thing, or is it different in King County, or just different wherever you work?
So I think it's different between counties. In Pierce, certainly if you could find somebody to switch with you, you may be able to get away with that for a couple rotations. But I don't know that your colleagues are going to look too fondly on you if you, for me, criminal is where that's my background and that's where I feel most comfortable. And so those are the cases I enjoy the most. Certainly if somebody was doing family court and then civil and then looked at my rotation and I'd been doing criminal court for 6 years, they may not think too fondly of that. So okay. It could probably happen, but I don't know that you'd be making many friends.
Well, I want to get back into your current world in a little bit, but I want to go backwards a little bit and understand. So I'm not sure where you went to college, but then, you know, did you know right away, like high school, college, that, hey, I want to be an attorney? Or did you say, I want to be a judge, but I know I need to be an attorney before?
So I did not want to be a judge. I don't even know that I really thought about what a judge was. I knew I wanted to be an attorney, however, in high school. I did a class called You and the Law, and we did a mock trial. And I can't remember what my role in the trial was, but I loved it. And so I went into college at Washington State University knowing that I wanted to eventually go into law school. So I'm trying to think of what my major was. I think it was an English and pre-law. So it was an English focus, but I did one of every other class you could possibly think of. Okay. And then I applied to some law schools. I got in at Seattle University. And at the time, that's when Seattle University was actually in Tacoma. And so I got in there and was put on the wait list actually at University of Washington, which was devastating to me because that's where I really wanted to go. I actually moved into an apartment in Tacoma, planned on going to law school here. And I think July of that summer, I got a letter that said, you've been removed from the wait list. Congratulations, you're accepted. And so I packed up my apartment, moved to Seattle, and went to law school in Seattle at the UW.
So being a coug, was that a problem?
No, I'm deep down, I'm always a coug. Law school is like a job. You know, you went every day, 9 to 5, and you left. It wasn't as, you weren't ingrained in the, I guess, sports and stuff as you were when you were an undergrad.
So my wife's a coug. I'm a husky. My stepdad's a coug. Well, actually he's not. He supports the cougs. And my stepbrother. So I'm surrounded by cougars. My daughter's boyfriend's going to play football there next year on a scholarship. So I'm one of those huskies that loves the Cougs. But what I realize is every time I tell my Coug friends I'm rooting for them, or they hate it. They don't want to hear a husky.
Yeah.
I don't understand that, but that's a different topic. But anyways, and by the way, I was born in Tacoma too. So we share some similar. Did you go to PLU ever, or was
no.
that? Okay.
Nope.
And then when did you meet Dean, just out of curiosity?
I met Dean in 1998. So I just wrapped up my first year in law school, I think. Maybe my second year.
Okay.
Can't remember. But all I met him when I was in law school.
So when you did that mock trial class that you said you enjoyed, was it just like, was that a, do you remember what about that you enjoyed? Was it like getting up in front of people, speaking, arguing your case? Is like, were you somebody that was just naturally good in front of people? Do you remember what felt good back then, or what kind of made things like, this is interesting?
Yeah. I don't know that I enjoy being in front of people necessarily, but I definitely enjoyed the trial aspect. I liked almost the investigative portion of it, you know, trying to find out what your argument was, presenting that. I did enjoy that. And ultimately I became a trial attorney. So clearly I did not end up being somebody, an attorney who sits behind a desk and reviews contracts. So certainly there was something in that mock trial that piqued my interest because, and then eventually I did become a trial attorney.
Okay. So I asked this question before, but I would love to hear your response. I asked this to the other judge I had a podcast with. So when you're going through law school, there's all flavor. You know, I work with divorce attorneys, for example, in lending. You know, there's real estate attorneys I work with. There's all kinds of different flavors and types of attorney that you can pursue, types of law that you can pursue. Do you kind of figure that out in law school, or is that something post law school, or do you go into law school thinking, oh, I know what I want to do?
So I actually went into law school, or I don't know if I went into law school, but once I was in law school, interestingly enough, I wanted to be a tax attorney, which if you were to say that to Dean, he would fall out of his chair laughing because he thinks I'm the most non-numbers person in the world. But what I loved about the tax law was that it's very A plus B equals C. You know, you look at a code and you it's black and white. There's no gray. It's black and white. And so I went into or started law school thinking that's what I want to do. I want an answer. I want to be able to look at a book, figure it out, and know that my answer is correct. And then you get to your first year summer and you have to get a job. And all of the jobs are in either public defender agencies, the attorney general, or prosecutor's offices, because that's who hires first year students. And so I just put my resume out there. And the first job that I was offered was at the prosecutor's office in Tacoma. I took it and I loved it. And I look back now and think, but for that, getting that job, I probably would have ended up being a tax attorney and I would have been pulling my hair out because I loved being a prosecutor. I was a prosecutor for 22 years before I became a judge and I absolutely loved it. And I can't think of any other career that would have given me so much joy as that career.
Okay. So obviously that was your life for a long time. You're intimate with what that means, but for maybe a younger person that's, you know, beyond the job description, when they Google it, and what does that mean? Tell us what that really is, like in a different light. Like, what exactly are you doing? How are you spending your time? Who are you helping? You know, what are the things that you had, the skill sets that you had that maybe translated to you being really good at it? What did you love about it so much?
So as prosecutor, you represent the state of Washington, and so you're prosecuting criminal defendants for crimes that you have alleged that they've committed. What a lot of people don't know is that there are a lot of other divisions within the prosecutor's office, and I think I did just about all of them. So when I got hired at our office as an appellate intern, so I would get the cases after they had already been tried and a conviction had been determined, and then they would appeal. And so I would review the transcript of the trial and I would argue all the legal issues, generally saying the court got it right. The prosecutor did this correct. And of course the defendant is saying my conviction should be reversed because this person and this person and this person got it wrong. I didn't know it at the time, but that was such amazing experience, not only going into being a trial attorney, but worth its weight in gold as a judge now, because I understand the importance of making a record. And I would have never known the importance of that without being an appellate attorney or an appellate intern. So as an appellate intern for 2 years, then I went down to our misdemeanor division where I prosecuted on behalf of the state all the simple misdemeanors. So DUIs, shopliftings, minor assaults. And I actually was assigned out to Gig Harbor. So I went out to Gig Harbor every day and did those cases. When I got promoted to felonies, I actually came back to appeals as an attorney and did appeals for a number of years. And then I went to the robbery and assault unit. And I loved that unit because that's where you really feel that you're doing good. I mean, you're representing victims of very serious crimes. You just walked away feeling like I did good today. And that's just an amazing feeling. It was hard work, but it was a really great job. I then went out to our juvenile division, and I was the assistant chief out there. And that's where I fell in love with just the idea of like juvenile justice and families and trying to find out what we can do to prevent criminal offenses in the future. And I went out there as people used to call me this hardcore prosecutor. You know, I never gave deals. And then I went out to Raymond Hall, which is our juvenile division. And and people would tease me and they'd say, "You've been juvenilized," because I really understood the importance of rehabilitation. And I took it to heart that, you know, kids are oftentimes a result of their environment. And if we can rehabilitate them before they enter the adult system, let's use every resource we can to do that. And so that was a really great experience for me. I loved my time out at Raymond Hall. And then they asked me to come back downtown. And they wanted me to go to the civil division, so which is another division that many people don't know we do. And it's essentially a law firm for the county. So we are the attorneys for all county employees. So no matter what happens, we will be the attorney that represents you. So for example, if you work for Public Works and you sprain your back pulling on a, you know, falling off a ladder, we would represent you. If you're in a car accident in a company car, we would represent you. I primarily focused on excessive force cases against our police officers. So any Pierce County Sheriff's deputies that were accused of civil rights violations or excessive force, I defended them. And the great thing about that is that that division takes you to all sorts of courts. You aren't limited to just practicing in Pierce County Superior Court. So I did cases in Eastern Washington, in Thurston County, in federal court. I argued cases to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that was just an amazing experience. And that's what I was doing when I got appointed to the bench. And I think that having that experience really helped me get the appointment to the bench, because it's really rare that you have somebody who has juvenile experience, appellate experience, criminal and civil. And I did not do that with the intent of being a judge someday. It just happened to be the path I took in my office, and it ended up really, really benefiting me in the end.
Yeah, I had no idea, for example, if you worked for the state or that you had these benefits. I mean, there's so many components of your world that I'm sure many people who are even like gung-ho about getting into law have no idea. So yeah. I think if you were to kind of summarize, there's lots of different options for somebody, and maybe one area would serve someone's skill sets really well, and maybe someone wouldn't do so well in another, but over time you might be able to kind of find your groove and find the right fit. Sound mm-hmm. okay?
Yeah.
One of the things you're talking about, the appeals, I was curious on is when earlier in one of your roles, you were the one dealing with like post conviction. Mm-hmm. What if you ever were reading the transcripts or the appeals and then you're like, I think the defendant or the person that you're going after has were you only representing the other side? Or what would happen if you said, you know what, I think they're right. I think they're wrongly convicted. Is that something that you would say? And like, does that get to be like a tricky situation?
So I've never had one where I've read it and thought this person is innocent, but I will. There have been plenty of times where I've reviewed the transcript and thought the state did this wrong. And whether that impacted the conviction, I don't know. But the prosecutor made a mistake or the judge made a mistake in admitting evidence or excluding evidence. And I would concede that. And that was the joy of the office that I worked for, is that we were not micromanaged. We had complete discretion to make our own professional decisions. And so those were, and I would always talk it over with my coworkers, but I would say, I think we need to concede error on this one. And the Court of Appeals would accept that. They'd remand it and the person would get a new trial if that's what they desired, or sometimes they'd plead to a lesser offense. And sometimes it would end up that the case would just get dismissed because time had passed and there were no new criminal convictions and the witnesses were in the wind. But no, I never had any hesitation to concede error when it was appropriate to do so.
Yeah. I was just trying to, I guess, ask, does it get political, you know, where you can't do that. Like you can't take down your side or say anything negative about your side, but it sounds like in the end of the day, truth is the best script, yeah. and you say what you feel.
Yeah. And I think that's largely dependent too on the kind of vibe of your office, and that's different between counties. But no, when I worked at the prosecutor's office, it was a really great environment and definitely truth seeking, do what's right. And that's how I operate. And so it was a good fit.
Okay. Curious. I've never known this. If you take the state of Washington, you said you're group 22. Is that Pierce
Department
County?
Department 22? No. Okay. So we have 23 judges and we each are our own department in Pierce County. So I'm Department 22.
Okay. So there's 23 judges in Pierce County.
Yep.
So if you take the whole state of Washington, are we talking about 500 judges?
No, or? I want to say, I just counted the other day, maybe 196. And it may have just gone over 200.
Okay. And this is a random question, but I'm just curious. So you have, let's just say 200 in bigger states, you might have 400, 300, mm-hmm. whatever. And then, so what are the next steps for someone? Like maybe you're content where you're at now, but if you want to rise up the ladder and kind of just like, I know Richard Jones has done that a little bit. And I don't really understand the trajectory of like, you know, how do you get to the Supreme Court judge, you know, yeah. like, is that the end all be all?
Well, it depends. You know, there's a lot of people that you would ask that have no desire at all to be any type of appellate judge. So the next levels in terms of judges, I'm a superior court judge, which is primarily trial court. Then there's the Court of Appeals. So you would be an appellate judge. So you wouldn't be doing trials. You would just be reviewing transcripts and making legal decisions. And then there's the Supreme Court, who is the, you know, ultra appellate court. A lot of trial judges that you ask what they want to do, they would rather jump out a window than go do appellate work because they really enjoy the atmosphere and the excitement and the energy of the trial level and seeing people every day. But there are those who do, you know, strive to be on the Supreme Court and have the ability to be on the Supreme Court. So it's really a personal thing. How you get there, it's almost like how you get to be a trial court judge. You either get there by appointment or you get there by election. And then some people strive to be a federal judge, just like Judge Jones. And those are somewhat political processes in that you're appointed by, I think you're appointed. I don't know who you're appointed by. Actually,
I know he was appointed by Bush back in the day.
I think it's the president that has the ultimate say. And yeah.
Yeah.
So so those are things. And I think that you have to go through a process of vetting in order to get to those positions. And so I think there are people that probably don't want to pursue that, but there are others that do.
So when you talk about prior to being a judge, like I envision what I see in a movie when you have two judges or two lawyers and a judge, and they say, all right, come up here. I need to talk to you or whatever. He gets mad or she gets mad. Like, were you one of those two people sitting on one side?
So yes, but I don't think I was ever really yelled at.
I
prided myself on being a nice co-counsel and or opposing counsel. Sure. And I always tried to treat the judges with respect. That's what the courtroom looks like.
Okay.
Two people and the judge up above. And
so when you're talking about what you liked or what lit you up or whatever, I just was trying to envision what that looked like. So I've seen a million movies and I understand the setup. So now I kind of have a clearer picture. I'm just thinking there's a jury, there's people watching, there's the judge. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts in that world. And I would think that I've always thought, like, when I when I see that, I'm like, wow, these attorneys are really amazing. It's just the ability to be controlled, articulate, to be persuasive, to be, you know, not talk fast, be, you know, it's a lot of skill sets I would think would translate to being good at what you did.
Yeah, it's, you know, I look back now and I think having only been a judge for 4 years but having to be on every single day and I guess having to make such public mistakes when I make them. I mean, I can never make a mistake that isn't in the public eye anymore. And that's really hard. I think now if I were to go back and be a trial attorney, I think, gosh, I'd be really good at it because I don't get nervous anymore. And so I think, well, I kind of wish I could go back and do some trials because I think I wouldn't let myself get so shaken. But it is a nerve-wracking experience because the majority of time, you don't know what somebody's going to say. They get scared. They get nervous. And so there was always this pressure of, I just really want this person to say what I know that they have said to me in our, you know, in our preparation interviews. I hope that this goes as planned, and it never does. There's always something that comes up. And so it's that last minute stress of you really just want to do right. But at the end of the day, you're stuck. And then there's people too that are your primary witnesses, and they're not necessarily not credible, but they have demeanors or nerves or anxiety that make them look like maybe they aren't credible. And those are really hard because you think, I really believe this person, but they are not presenting well, and I can't control how they present themselves to the jury. And at the end of the day, I will say, I think juries get it right. I don't know that I had one case when I was a district court attorney that it was a reckless driving case, and it was so clear that the person had committed reckless driving, and they found the person not guilty. And I just remember being shocked. And when I walked into the jury room, the jurors looked at me and they said, "Miss Burton, are you going to tell us now if he's really guilty?" And I said, "Well, actually, you just told me that he wasn't. So that was your decision." But other than that, I think every time I've walked out of a courtroom, whatever the verdict, I've thought to myself, they got it right. That was a good verdict. And I've thought the same too as a judge. For the most part, the juries get it right.
So what is, tell us about, like, in the world of being a judge, what is it that you didn't see coming that maybe most people won't experience until they're actually sitting, you know, as a judge for a while? Like, is there anything, like, you go home at night and talk to Dean and you're like, man, I did not expect this?
Yes. Yes. Imposter syndrome. I mean, I like to think that I was a really confident attorney. I mean, by the time I came to the bench, I'd been a prosecutor for 22 years. I knew what I was doing. I did it well. And nothing rattled me. You know, I could walk into really any situation, and maybe I didn't know all of the facts, but I was still able to bluff and feel like, yeah, I'll bluff my way through it. And I'm confident enough to do that. And then I took the bench and I just felt like such an imposter. Like, what am I doing here? I don't know what I'm doing. I shouldn't be here. Didn't anticipate was just the constant voice in my head that doesn't shut off anymore. And it could be, you didn't say that the right way. You were too judgmental of that person. You could have been kinder. You could have sounded better. It never stops. And then I think about the kids who I've removed from a home or placed back into a home, and the people that I've sentenced. And I just sometimes think I have too much empathy for this job because I take so much of it on myself, and it gets really hard to handle sometimes. And so that would be the thing that I did not anticipate.
Yeah. I remember when I first met you, when we were watching our kids down, I think it was PLU playing lacrosse. Mm-hmm. It was a tournament. Yep. And we started talking about the challenges or the difficulty of the cases you're dealing with, like especially with custody battles, for example. And that's just a heavy, heavy, like, I can't imagine ever going through that, you know, a divorce and then not being with my kids all the time. And I guess the question I have is, I had a little experience. I went back to school for psychology. I thought I was going to be a child psychologist, and I did really well in school. Like, I had a 4.0, and I'm not a smart guy. I'm not a dumb guy, but I'm just not a, I'm not a 4.0 kind of guy. But I was really into the content. But what really triggered me was the case studies we would do and the role playing. And, you know, I realized, like, if I'm working with a young boy who's getting you know, abused or beaten up by his dad. I don't know if I could not go over and talk to his dad, you know, knock on his door. So my point is, like, I realized, like, I don't think I'm built for this career. And I was thinking when we first met and we were talking, like, I guess the question is, what is the muscle or the skill set that a judge needs to have to kind of let it keep it at work and go home so you can be a mom and a wife and not be like this emotionally drained person?
Yeah. I'm still working on it. I think that at the end of the day, I really just try and tell myself I did the best I could. And I really feel like I make good decisions. I make them from my heart. I make them from the perspective of not only a judge, but as a mom, as a wife, as just a human. And so I just have to remind myself to give myself grace, and that the reason I take on so much is because I'm probably a good person to be making these decisions. You know, I'd be more concerned if I left this office every day and just said, hey, let's go grab a beer. No, nothing happened today. And Dean said that to me. Dean says, you realize that there are certain people that this doesn't affect at all. And that's not necessarily a good thing. And I just need to remember that this is a good thing that this impacts me. And I just find ways or outlets. So I have a huge support system at work. I have my group of three other female judges who are my go-to people, truly. I mean, I have stepped off the bench before in tears over an abuse neglect case, and I've picked up the phone and one of them has answered and talked me down. So I have the group of support at work. I still run every single morning. My alarm goes off at 5:30, and that, I mean, midway through my run, I can just feel the tension go out. And then I just have been really conscious too about making sure I get good sleep, that I eat healthy. You know, Dean and I used to go out to dinner and grab a glass of wine, and I don't do that as much because I just know how important getting a good night's sleep is. And I feel like I sound like I'm 72 years old, but I don't know. I know what I need in order to operate on all cylinders, and that's it. And so I've really tried to just take care of myself in that way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. A great point, actually, is because I think that, like, people don't really know at 23, 24, 26, whatever, like, they think they want to be a doctor, an attorney, or a pilot or whatever, but they don't really know, like, what it's like. Like, you know, they can read a job description and understand kind of what it they do. But, like, what you're talking about, I think in order for somebody like you to be effective, you really have to take care of your body and your spirit and your health, or else you don't show up as an effective judge or an attorney. And I think if you're watching this and listening to Leisha, and you really gotta, like, be somebody, you gotta, I don't know if the word's holistic, but you really gotta, you know, become the best version of yourself. And I would assume if you were a judge that went to the bars to drown your sorrows and woke up with a hangover and weren't sleeping well, you probably wouldn't be a great judge. You wouldn't be alert. So I think that's a really good point. What do you love? So you told me what surprised you. I never want to be negative, but, like, every job has its pros and cons. Is there something about, other than the emotional toll it can take on you, is there something you just don't like at all about being a judge?
Well, believe it or not, I'm really conflict avoidant. Which is funny that I'm a judge, because I deal with conflict every day. And I am one of those people, what do they call it? Fight or flight or freeze. And I freeze. When I see conflict, I freeze. I can't think. My brain quits working. And so I hate that. And I'm working on that. And I guess that's another thing that I didn't realize I did until I took this job. And then it took me about 2 years to realize I'm not able to think when people, so when people are in my courtroom and they start fighting with each other, my brain just shuts down. And I'll tell them, I'll say, when you do that, I quit listening and I can't process what you're telling me. And it works. They quit fighting and they, you know, get along. But so that, I hate that I do that. The other thing is,
sorry to say this, but I think it's really great that you're aware of that. You know, I mean, I think awareness of that makes, I mean, I think a lot of people aren't aware of yeah. maybe things they don't do well or whatever. So I think that's great awareness.
Yeah. And the other thing made reference to this earlier. I think the hardest part about this job is that every mistake you make is public. So if you say something that comes off the wrong way or could be perceived in a negative light, it's heard by multiple people. It's on a record. It's in a transcript. And that is, so you're just constantly on, like, how am I going to say this? What am I going to say this? How am I, you know, what words am I going to use? And when, going back to when you're not operating on all cylinders, you aren't as aware of what you're saying, and it can sometimes get you into trouble. And then that's where you step off the bench and you think, I didn't really handle that well. Now that attorney's mad at me. There's a record of me saying that. And then your mind starts spinning.
That's interesting. I was just thinking about the, you have to be on, but then, you know, when you go home and in your personal world, like with Dean and your kids and so forth, you kind of don't want to have to think about being on. You want to be natural, right?
Yeah.
So is that hard to turn off, or is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I'll go home and Dean will ask a question. Where do you want to go to dinner? I'm done making decisions. You tell me where we're going. I just want to just go. I don't want to think. I don't want to make a decision.
Yeah, I get it. Well, how about something you really love? Like, instead of, maybe that's an easy answer that you'll give me, but something maybe that you didn't know early on, or maybe something that took time to develop that, because I think this podcast for me is not only to educate, but I also like to interview people like you that are in their flow, that are doing things. I see people who are successful, and a lot of those people usually really enjoy what they do. Mm-hmm. So they have aligned their careers with their skill sets, their passions, and, you know, they're not faking it, because you can only fake it for so long that, you know, and I've seen people do that and they burn out. What is it that you love about, you know, what you do that you're proud of? So when you go home and you go to bed, and is it as simple as you feel like you're just making people's lives better, or what is that thing that you love?
So I think it's the cases that you really have an impact on. And I'll give you an example. So when I was in juvenile court doing the abuse and neglect cases, I had a particular case, it's closed now, so I can talk about it. I had a particular case that involved a mom with substance use issues. She had a daughter that at the time, I think was about 3, who had heart conditions. And as you know, our son has had open heart surgeries. And so I immediately connected with her just on a mom level of having a child who has needed open heart surgeries. And I think they even have very similar congenital heart defects. And so the child was placed with, I think, a foster family, maybe a relative member of the family, but not at home with mom. Mom had since had another baby, and the state of Washington had determined that she was safe enough to keep that baby at home. And so when the case came before me, I thought, well, this is really weird. You know, that the state obviously isn't as so concerned about this mom that they don't think she can't take care of her infant, because they're letting the infant stay at home. But they're apparently so concerned about the 3-year-old with the heart issue that they're requiring that she be out of home. And it was this catch 22 for the mom, because they were saying, well, you can't have visits with her until you're trained medically. But then she couldn't get trained medically because she wasn't allowed to have visits with her. And all of this was during COVID. So then they kept throwing in the COVID restriction and saying, oh, and because of your living situation, we don't want you near your daughter because you might expose her to COVID. And so this woman would appear crying every time and say, I'm trying to do what they want me to do, but I can't do it because it's just, I can't get access to the child. And then they want me to have access to the child to learn the medical protocol, but I can't do that because I don't know the medical protocol. So I ended up just ordering that they be reunited for visitation and forget about the COVID, forget about supervision. She gets, or I think I still ordered supervision, but I said, she gets to be with the child. She gets to go to the medical appointments. Long story short is that Within 6 months, the child was returned home. The mom had completely learned everything she needed to learn. Ironically, the child ended up getting COVID from the foster family, not the mom, and did fine with the child did fine with COVID, got through her 10 days of isolation, and eventually was returned to mom. I ended up dismissing the dependency case. And the mom to this day emails me probably once a month, and asks, you know, can we get together? I want you to see the kids. She's doing great. She has custody of all of her children now. She is working, she's sober. And so those are the cases. They're few and far between, but they are the ones that just make this job worth it 100%, because you have a lot of hard cases in between and ones that don't necessarily have positive results. But the ones that do, just they stick with you and they make the hard days so much easier.
Yeah. I won't get into detail, but years ago I needed an attorney for something I was going through that wasn't my fault, but I was kind of nervous and I was like new to this, you know. And I can tell you what a difference having help, you know, whether it's an attorney or a judge. Like, I know there's a lot of jokes about attorneys and so, but like at the end of the day, when you can make a difference and really help people that are like at a low point.
Yeah.
I can understand how that might feel. This kind of came up and I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question, but and I was thinking about it too when I was reading your bio about when you were appointed. I think you said January 2nd, mm-hmm. 2000 is when you started. And Jay Inslee was the one, the governor was the one. So like, what if you're like, I guess the question is, do you have to be political? Like, do you have to play the game to do what you do? And like, for example, I'm not going to get into detail, but there's a lot of things I don't agree with Jay Inslee on. And I was very challenged during COVID with pushing vaccinations and, you know, the freedom of people. And my question is like, when you work for a big corporation, sometimes you don't have a say. You have to play by the rules versus if you're an independent. I guess what I'm asking you is, do you have to, can you have a strong opinion? Like, and, or do you have to like follow the crowd and do what everyone else is telling you to do? Like, do you have to be liberal in the state of Washington to be looked at as a judge, or can you be far right and will you not even be considered?
So I can tell you that I'm probably the least political person you may ever meet. So you do not have to be political or align yourself with the political views of the person appointing, because somehow I got the appointment and I am not political at all. In terms of having opinions and views, yes, you are limited in terms of how vocal you can be about those. Nothing requires you not to have them, but you do have to set them whenever you are presiding over a case. So if you never want to be out in the public, and there's so many rules that govern us about what we can say and what we can't say. And you basically can't be public about an opinion that could be someday appear as an issue in front of you, which is virtually everything. So, but it doesn't mean you can't have them. You just have to set them aside.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You can be individual and you can have your own beliefs, but I guess as a judge, you have to be careful, but especially with social media and so forth, yeah. What's out there.
Yeah.
What haven't I asked you? I mean, this is your world, not mine, but think about the young person that's struggling and they're really like having a hard time trying to figure out what they want to do. And they're thinking this area is there a question I haven't asked or something I haven't brought up that you think would be crucial for them to know?
I just think just being a lawyer in general, you know, so few people are judges. And I don't know many people that go into law school with the idea of my end goal is to be a judge. I certainly didn't. And there's just not a lot of opportunity. I mean, as I just said, you know, there's 200 state judges in Washington at our level. And then, of course, more if you consider the lower courts and the appellate courts. But I think just in terms of being a lawyer in general is find your niche within the law that that brings you passion, because it's a thankless job and it's a high conflict job. It's become even more high conflict, I feel like, in the last couple of years. And so you really have to love what you do. I know so many attorneys that fell into, you know, family law, or they fell into real estate law or contract law or whatever. They just fell into probably the job that was available at the time they needed a job, and they hate it. Dean, my husband, your friend, you know, he fell into family law after graduating from NYU Law School, and he hated it. And he was out and not being a lawyer after, what, 5 years? And so it can be such an amazing job, but you just have to find the subject matter that fits for you.
Yeah, that's really, I was going to ask you advice, but you just nailed it right there. I really like what you said. Before I forget, one of the questions I have is just kind of like the lifestyle, like things that people don't think about. You know, like even in my world, I do lending, real estate lending, but I have some side hustles that, you know, make kind of fill my soul, like writing a book, podcasts. I do things like that. But like, what is it like as far as freedom? Freedom's a big thing for me, my ability to control my own schedule. Like as a judge, do you feel like, are you constantly tied to your phone, or can you go home, shut it off, and or are you always having to worry about, you know, somebody at work calling you, and can you take off for a month? Can you go live in Sun Valley, Idaho? And probably not a judge, but like you're kind of isolated. You have to be here, but what about the freedom? Like, can you get away when you need to get away?
So I definitely feel like I have less freedom now as a judge than I did as a prosecutor. And that's just because I'm elected by the citizens of the county, and I feel an obligation to be here and get their cases through the system. And so that's more on my own obligation. You know, we get a lot of recess vacation a year. And so I certainly am able to take my vacations, take my personal days. I can get to my medical appointments, but like, particularly when I have a jury, that's in a jury trial that's going on, I feel really protective of the jurors' times. We pay them $10 a day. And so I don't want them thinking that the judge is rolling in at 2 and leaving at 4. I'm really, really protective of their time. But so no, I can't take 6 weeks in Sun Valley as much as I'd love to. But I mean, I definitely get my time away. And as, but I laughed when you said, are people calling you? I don't have a cell phone as a judge. I have my personal cell phone, but we are not issued judicial cell phones. And in some ways I'm glad. There are times that I think it would be easier for someone to get a hold of me on an issue that I need an answer to. But there are other times where I think that is my last ability to turn it off. And if I have a cell phone, a work cell phone in my pocket, I'm going to lose that last little shred of my own personal time that I have. So I'm fine not having one.
I love it. And not what you make, because I never asked that question, but I think compensation in terms of how somebody is paid is really important. Is it a base salary? Is there any kind of variable income, like commission, bonus?
Nope. So it's all all a base salary. And interestingly enough, all Washington state judges get paid the same, regardless of where you live. So think about that. If you're a judge in King County versus a judge in Yakima, your cost of living is very, very different, but we all make the exact same amount. But we also have a pension program, and it's an amazing pension program. And so our salary is what it is, but the pension is what makes our jobs just a wonderful opportunity, because it's a really good pension program.
So I had a friend that was, his older brother was a baseball player for the Mariners, and he was good. He was a journeyman catcher. And I remember when he finally got to that final year, so he had the pension for life, it was a big deal. Do you, versus like getting cut, not making a team, is there like, is it 10 years, 15, 20? I mean, is there a period of time as a judge that you need to be working in order to get a pension?
You know, I don't know how it works if you have come in to be a judge without having a public employment history before, because I came in and so my public employee retirement status just flipped over to the judge one. So I've only ever looked at my number of years as a public employee, which has been my entire career. I don't know how it works for somebody who did a private career and, you know, only say as a judge for the last 10 years of their career. I'm not sure how that works. I know that you still get a pension. I just don't know how that calculation works.
Okay, cool. I'm winding down. I'm just trying to think if I missed anything. Oh, one question I have, just the nature of the type of law you did as a prosecutor, but also the trials that you see as a judge. Are you ever fearful of you? I mean, you're dealing with some heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And like, do you feel threatened ever? Or do you feel like, maybe I shouldn't ask you directly, but do judges ever feel like that's something that somebody needs to be aware of, maybe if they want to be in that world? I mean, if you're doing real estate law, you probably don't have to worry about it. But if you're doing criminal cases or child custody, and maybe the dad got pissed off because you did whatever, like, is that something that plays a part in your life?
It does and it doesn't. Sometimes I think I'm too nonchalant maybe about it. And interestingly enough, the criminal cases have never worried me. I have always, for the most part, had great rapport with the criminal defendants that have appeared in my courtroom. They've been very respectful. I treat them with respect. I always ask them how they're doing. I say good morning to them. I make eye contact with them. And I think they know, I mean, they know once they've been convicted, they know the sentencing range, and I'm bound by a range unless there's a reason to go above that. And so in some ways it's not, I'm not throwing away the key or doing something to anybody, because when they come to my court for their sentencing, I'm bound by a certain range anyway. The cases where I think people get the most emotional are the ones involving children. And those are both the abuse and neglect, where you're sometimes removing children from homes. Mm-hmm. And certainly the child custody cases where you're deciding parenting plans. And I'm a parent. I get it. I mean, nothing is going to bring out my mama bear more than something that is done to my children. And so those are the ones actually that I think are more emotional and have the potential to be a little bit more scary in terms of being the decision maker. And those are also the ones I'm the decision maker. That's the other thing with the criminal cases. The jury's making the decision. I'm just sentencing if it ends up in a conviction. I'm the decision maker on every single family law case. And so that's hard, because at the end of the day, it's my decision that made a determination of where that child goes.
Yeah, no, I would think that for me personally, that would be difficult. But I assume you just find a way to work it out. And I am curious, does Dean ever win an argument with you? Like, I would think that he's just dead in the water, like nothing.
No. Yeah. No, he wins all of them because I give up. He plays devil's advocate with me all the time and he drives me crazy. And so I just give up and I walk away.
You're probably so spent. You're just like, whatever, Dean, that's fine. Well, thank you so much. One other question I always ask is, if you weren't a judge and a prosecutor, let's just say the whole legal world, the law was just not an option. Is there a dream job? Like, is there something? And I always ask this because it's curious, because sometimes I get answers that surprise me. Sometimes someone says, no, I'm doing what I love. But if you couldn't do what you're doing now, but you had to, you know, find a dream career, is there something out there?
Oh gosh. I always wanted to work at Red Robin. I don't know that I'd do that now.
I don't know if you could get hired.
You know what I would be? Well, I always wanted before actually, I always wanted to be an FBI agent. So I would consider that. I would actually love being a park ranger. I love to hike. I love the outdoors. It is my happy place. That is where I get my sanity back, is hitting the mountains in the summer months. And I think I just had a case the other day where one of the parents was a park ranger and she lives in the national park. Her rent is $127 a month. Everything's paid for. And she gets to live in a national park. And I thought, man, if I could do it all over again.
That's pretty cool. I know we talked about you guys coming out to Mount Si. because we're right underneath Mount Si. There's some great hikes out here. Yeah. So we'll have to get you guys on the books, and because we're for like sure. a couple miles from the base. Yeah, no, I like what you just said. I love this movie Into the Wild, and it's a little extreme, but I'm just always fascinated by the scenes where he's out there just kind of living in nature. And I think I'm kind of an introvert. I like people. I like hanging out, but I like my time and my space. Yep. And I think too. I could enjoy that as well. Thank you so much for coming on. I know you've had a big day and busy week, and I think you were awesome, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dirk.
All right. Take care. All right.